Fakeless Nation is the second week of February. We got the Super Bowl behind us. David, you watch some of those commercials?
I did watch the commercials. Yeah. Oh, I think I know. Are we about to watch a commercial?
I think this was the only crypto commercial that was actually at the Super Bowl. Okay. Is that right? I mean, there's a lot of AI commercials.
That's right.
Okay.
That's right.
Yeah. Here was the reaction. This is from somebody's living room, a reaction to the Coinbase commercial, Backstreet Boys. This is Backstreet's Back is what they went with. Here it is.
The double bird. Did you watch this live?
Yeah, I watched this live.
I also watched it live.
Okay, so who were you with? Were you family, friends?
Yeah, it was me and a friend. Yeah.
Okay, so what was the reaction around you when... So first of all, the commercial, obviously you guys saw that, but it starts with Backstreet Boys, really reels you in, right? The lyrics are on the screen, very simple.
You also don't
background.
Know what's going on. You're like, oh, we're doing karaoke. We're doing Backstreet Boys karaoke. Don't know who this is. Don't know what's going on, but I'm down for it.
Grabbed everyone's attention, roped them all in because
it was a little odd,
song.
Which is why it was attention grabbing.
That's right. Okay. So what was the reaction when the your lyrics faded out and Coinbase popped up there? Crypto's for everybody.
Like my reaction was like, oh, Coinbase.
That was your reaction.
Okay. All right. Like even I've like felt got. I felt got.
Did you feel rug pulled? A little rug pulled?
Yes, I felt. Well, like it's for me, it's Coinbase. And so like, you know, thumbs up for me.
You feel good about that.
But like, you know, if my perception of Coinbase was negative or if my perception of crypto was negative, I would indeed feel rug pulled.
You just,
like I said, I felt got. But then I realized that like this is... They're doing a little switcheroo the watcher.
Yeah, I felt got, but in a way that was like, oh, well played. Like you well played, Coinbase.
Yes.
But then I looked around, and again, because that's because I'm crypto favorable, and I have a fond thoughts
we appreciate
about
Coinbase,
crypto.
Yeah, all that stuff. Yeah.
Everyone in the room I was with my family, and they all kind of looked at me, and they all groaned. Right, they were all like, they looked at me, right, because I'm the crypto guy. So do you think this was a good ad or not? There's a lot of back and forth on crypto this way. And like, we can't, it was a good ad from the perspective of it attracted everyone's attention. And
there was big discussion afterwards about everyone.
So undoubtedly that is true. But
it was undoubtedly a negative reception about the ad. Like essentially universal dissatisfaction, unhappiness with getting quote unquote rugged. About the ad. Is that bad as a whole? Like I saw Brian Armstrong's tweet about it. Like, you know, we wanted to create a universal moment where everyone is singing together in this one moment.
Yes.
And that's like emblematic of crypto. Like get everyone onto the same system, upgrade the system, get everyone on board together, get everyone on the same ship. And we just wanted to provide that moment to the viewer. And I'm like, okay, that's a very naively optimistic interpretation of what could happen. In reality, I think... like Coinbase shouldn't be naive about the state of crypto PR in 2026. It's not great. Potentially it's the worst ever since FTX.
Yeah.
And I think that was like understood in the ad itself, where like they needed to rug pull people in order to get them on board. So first they got them on board. They leveraged the Backstreet Boys.
Yes.
To get everyone on board, because who doesn't like the Backstreet Boys? You know, millennials are of the main consuming age, and then they yoinked them. And I think you can't really say that like the Coinbase marketing team didn't know what they were doing when they tried to do this strategy.
I feel like in a box, the whole thing works. It's just kind of a timing thing. And the other contrast point I'll say is when crypto was big at the Super Bowl last time, I think that was like 2022, right? It was February of 2022.
Yeah.
And Coinbase had a commercial there. It was actually similar to this. So they kind of ran that play back because that was effective. FTX had a fantastic commercial. Crypto.com did a Matt
Damon
thing.
What's his name? The guy from
Larry David?
Larry David. Yeah.
Yeah.
Great ad.
It was a fantastic...
And Larry David ended up on top on that one because his whole bit was like, I'm never wrong about this stuff and I don't think crypto's real.
Yeah.
And so he was just like negging FTX, which ended up being great for him.
But the nice thing about that ad, and of course, FTX turned out to be the largest rug pull of all rug pulls, like absolutely terrible for anyone who watched it and actually opened an FTX account. So that aside, but that ad was about the change that crypto was bringing about.
Yes.
There was something positive about that ad. And there's something forward looking about how crypto can change the world, like great inventions.
There were notes
history.
Of optimism in the ad.
Yeah, and this didn't have that. Not to say that if you played that same ad, there's no way it would work in 2026 in this climate either.
Yeah.
It's just like, I think there's a meta point here of crypto, at least in a pop narrative perspective, and what is the Super Bowl if not its popular cultural narrative, is it doesn't have a thing. It doesn't have a, in the popular consciousness, a purpose, a broader purpose that it is solving for.
Yeah.
And crypto people are like, but money and store of value and bankless future. But the public no longer believes that and does not believe it at this current flashpoint in 2026.
Yeah.
And I don't think that's Coinbase's fault.
Nope.
Maybe you could say at some level it's crypto's fault, but I don't even know. It's just the point at in time.
It's what
in
we
which
got.
We are.
It's the cards
it's what
that
we, got.
We are dealt.
The cards
That's
that
right.
were dealt at this point in time.
It is worth saying that like every other Coinbase ad that I've seen has been a banger in terms, not the last Super Bowl ad. The last Super Bowl ad, they just put a QR code on the screen and then everyone was like, it was also kind of a gotcha.
Yeah, it was.
Of like, just throw a QR code on the screen and then everyone's going to scan it and then we'll just take them to the Coinbase download page on the App Store.
Yeah.
And that was a gotcha, but like I think people like that one. But all the other ads, the upgrade the system ads, the ad about the farmer in Texas who is frequently hamstrung by his ability to pay people until he found Coinbase to use stable coins, like inherently optimistic about the, you know, the long tail of America, the individual who's benefited by the permissionlessness and accessibility of crypto.
That's right.
And they've always been so good.
I think I would have preferred that
ads,
this year. I would have preferred that
because it would have been contra to the current PR understanding that society has about crypto.
Crypto is gambling and rug pulls.
Yes. And then Coinbase could have come in and said, no, we are upgrading the system. The old financial system doesn't work for people. And here's our message of optimism and technological progress. And we didn't get that.
All right. This is David and I volunteering as advisors to the next big crypto marketing push at the Super Bowl of 2027. We got to get to the weekly roll-up, David. Crypto got absolutely demolished last week, down 15%. And that was after being down something like 10%. Yeah. What happened? Did we blow up? Is crypto completely cooked?
And then Layer 0 announces a Layer 1 to challenge both Ethereum and Solana. Fed up with the slow progress of Ethereum, they're just doing it themselves, rolling their own code. Does Layer 0 have a shot of entering into the top 10, top 5 chains of crypto?
Prediction markets also reached new highs, partly due to the Super Bowl, I think. But some of this attention is not all good. There's some pushback. Yeah. There's some incumbent controversy. So we'll talk about that. Also, the Farcaster founders, they have now joined Tempo, the former Farcaster founders. I think this opened up a broader conversation about the end of non-financial apps and use cases in crypto and whether we'll see them in the future or crypto is just meant to be finance.
We'll get into all of that and more, but first a message from our friends and sponsors over at Rocket Pool, who are launching their long-awaited Saturn upgrade. This is essentially Rocket Pool V2. It's lowering the stake size, the bond size from Rocket Pool from 8 to 4. So you can get even more leverage on the yield of staking Ether. You stake 4 ETH and run a node. Other people will come and stake 28 ETH to make a 32 ETH node, but you charge all of them a fee. So if you want more ETH yield, as well as to check out all the other features that are coming to Rocket Pool with this added upgrade, you can check that out at bankless.cc/Rocket Pool. This launch is happening February 18th. Congratulations to Rocket Pool and the Rocket Pool community for this upgrade. It has been a long time coming for the Saturn upgrade. It's finally here. It's pretty exciting.
Absolutely, OGs, but you want your staking upgrades to be very methodical and slow.
Yes.
But by the way, on staking, did you see that ETH as a percent of staking supply is now all-time high?
Yeah.
It's above 30% now.
It's destiny to go up only.
Okay, well, that seems good to me. That seems like it's conviction. People are staking, you know, they're
transferring
these are
from strong hands
owners.
To weak hands. No, weak hands to strong hands.
Yeah, maybe there's some of that going on. Okay, well, it doesn't mean it's going to be pretty in the process, though. Let's take a look at the blood in the numbers this week. So what's Bitcoin showing us?
Down 5% to $66,000. We're even dumping a little bit at the time of recording. Wow, $66,000 flat, perfectly flat. ETH doing something similar, down 7% to $1,900 where we are right now. We do have what looks like a generational bottom on Bitcoin, I think is what it is called.
Is that what Bitcoin, it's called?
Yeah, generational bottom. So Bitcoin is in the bottom 5% of its entire price history relative to the 200-day moving average.
Wow.
And so we are in a 5% idiosyncratic moment, whereas as you compare the current Bitcoin price to the 200-week moving average, it is very rarely this low. So either is a generational bottom or we're cooked and like, you know, pack it up.
So the only two possibilities.
Only two possibilities. Yeah, that's right.
What are you going with? Are we cooked or
generational bottom? Generational bottom.
I'm going with that as well.
Yeah.
This is Benjamin Cohen making an appearance and saying, welcome back home. This is some sort of weekly average extrapolation that he likes to use. It's his kind of band, his rainbow type band. And you can see ETH is driving towards the bottom of that band, but it's in kind of a long-term band since 2015, if you want to compare it this way.
Ben Cohen was saying ETH is going to quote unquote go home. This is a Ben Cohen meme and return to that like regression band. And it did something like 4 or 5 months ago.
Yes.
And then we had him on to talk about that because like this is a huge meme in the Ben Cohen universe that ETH is finally going home. Took way longer than he thought. Finally did go home. And then we brought him on. And then I remember him saying like, and then it's going to bounce back up and then it could go home again. And I'm like, damn it.
It's like a curse.
And here we are.
We are also at 2.34 trillion.
God, that
so
is so
if you recall, there was a time we were at 4.2 trillion. So we've shed about 2 trillion on total crypto market cap. David, I kind of thought we were going to get to 10 trillion this cycle and we didn't get there.
Not quite.
Definitely
just
muted
a
cycle.
Narrow miss of 6 trillion off.
We're going to talk about the big sell-off that we saw last week, but I want to just get your vibe check on sentiment. So I've seen a lot of conversation about like crypto people saying, this feels worse than post-FTX 2022. Do you think this feels worse? Do you think the sentiment is worse now in crypto than the last bear cycle after all of the rug pulls and everything that happened then?
I think why this feels so much worse than FTX.
So, yes, I do think this
is that FTX happened to us and it was like an unforced error that we felt like we still have with the power of DeFi, right? We still have so much juice left to squeeze with
public
blockchain.
Enemies to blame.
We had enemies to blame. It was like, well, this happened to us. You know, maybe we did the Terra Luna, like, you know, there's these external reasons as to like why we are down bad right now.
Yeah.
But like, that's just now we're just going to wait for DeFi to mature even more and we're going to do more things and put more
Gensler
people on chain.
Out of office.
Yeah. All that stuff. There were like a ton of catalysts. And now it's like, this is just endogenous. Like the price action. Why is this price action happening? It seems to be because, I don't know, the world knows about DeFi. We've squeezed the juice out of DeFi. Like, We've done a lot of the stuff and prices are where they are. And so I think it's like just a lack of control over the price. I think people feel a lack of agency over what the crypto industry itself can do to our own prices. Hmm. And that feels helpless. And I think that there's been just a broad lack of conviction or loss of faith in like some of the core premises of what crypto is, which is why it feels so bad.
I get that. And I think that's true. Although I will say every 4 years, it's something.
Yeah.
And this is just that something this time.
Yep.
You know what I mean? So I see that it's different in what the thing actually is that makes everyone bearish, but it was always going to be something. And this time it's like, oh, we have no one to blame. Like, you know, we had a kind of a weak cycle. Let's get into what actually happened on Friday, because that was the mother of all dips. I think Jim Bianco said this was the fourth worst day this decade for Bitcoin prices. And I think actually it turned into maybe the third worst day. So Friday was worse than the FTX failure in 2022, worse than the
Terra price action?
In terms of price action,
Christ.
Worse than the Terra Luna collapse, worse than the 2020 COVID shutdown in terms of daily percent changes here, David. So like, what happened? Did something blow up?
There are a handful of reasons, as I understand it. Gold is just super volatile, which is making the rest of the market very jittery. That's the sell-off that we're happening right now. We're watching right now is gold and silver is getting pummeled on the day of recording, Thursday. We had SaaSpocalypse, which I didn't know, but Bitcoin and crypto has been very tied to SaaS as a sector. Yeah. And there's worries about AI coming and disrupting SaaS. I think that's overblown. Jim Bianco also kind of thinks that's overblown. There's like weak labor signals as well. But there's like, if you're into reasons, there's probably plenty to find.
Yeah.
Ultimately, I don't know. Market's going down. Market's going up.
But I mean, there was a question. This felt like forced selling. We got on the feed and greed index to kind of like extreme fear territories. And people were saying that the selling is looking like it's becoming forced, looking like it's becoming emotional. The Kobayashi letter said, not even the record $20 billion liquidation on October 10th came close to today. It appears that someone big was liquidated. So we see all of that. And at the same time, we saw IBIT, which is the BlackRock Bitcoin ETF, with its highest volume day in history. That happened last week as well. So on that Friday, the day of the big crypto Bitcoin sell-off, IBIT's secondary market trading hit a record volume of $10.7 billion. It's had lots of derivatives, options trading against it as well. And that $10 billion in IBIT trading, that is suspiciously big scale.
So
part of the take here or a consideration is there could have been some TradFi type actors that were playing with lots of different instruments, maybe speculating on some of the assets that we just talked about, precious metals, gold, silver. We don't know where they were, and they got liquidated. They got taken out in some way, and they needed to liquidate some of their IBIT collateral in a hurry, and this caused a cascade. So it's possible someone was blown out or seriously damaged, and they weren't actually a crypto native company and firm. They were in TradFi. Yeah. And that now, because IBIT and because Bitcoin crypto assets are so tied into the rest of the financial system, we just took a volatility extreme hit along with some of that liquidation in TradFi assets.
Yeah. Price discovery, at least from what people can understand about this recent price action, price discovery happened using the ETFs, not anything that happened. So it was kind of like, well, we are the smaller of the market. So it was like then the trad market is the bigger one. So the dog did wag the tail and we are the tail in this circumstance.
Yeah. I mean, there's some that are now doing a retrospective on why crypto is having such a bad year so far. And people, of course, pointing to the 1010 slaughter. This is Alex Kruger. He's got a few things listed. There's a hangover from the digital asset treasuries, quantum fears, which are maybe somewhat real. Maybe that's affecting things. The AI opportunity distraction, of course, that's ongoing. The institutions and the swamp, he says, taking over and overcrowding OGs. So this pivot from cypherpunk and rebel tech, it's all about TradFi and ETFs. An oversupply of coins, Trump and his kind of corruption and associated political risk. People are like, well, when the Democrats take charge, they're going to reverse all of these favorable crypto things. And he concludes that killed the momentum. And then came the nomination of Warsh, and the market suddenly became deeply aware that Warsh is a strong advocate of a small balance sheet. And so that was kind of the crushing blow for crypto. So as we said, if you want reasons, those are some reasons.
There are
some. There are some. And you can definitely, I guess, connect those dots if you want to. Another thing you could just say is it's a four-year cycle and it was time.
Random walk. And a random walk. We just randomly walked down.
Yeah.
And we are in a like top 5% extreme situation for Bitcoin. And perhaps you can take advantage of that.
I am enjoying this poly market on the price of Bitcoin in 2026. And let's look at the odds that Bitcoin falls below 50K this cycle. So 50K, the odds right now are 66%.
That's really high. That's really high. 66% chance that we lose $16,000 off of Bitcoin. The equivalent price in the other direction, 72% chance that it goes up to $80,000. Oof.
So you can hedge, you can trade on Bitcoin price on Polymarket if you so wish. You can also like just think about setting buy ticks, you know, under 50K.
Oh yeah, you can use Polymarket to inform your stink bids. Yeah, dude, there's $17 million of volume on this. I'm very interested in the increasing robustness of this as a financial instrument and if that actually gets integrated into people's overall strategies.
Yeah, I don't. Speaking of strategies, you know, strategy is actually nice. Using this dump to buy more. So I don't know if they're looking at Polymarket or what
are
they're
they
looking at.
Are they using this dump to buy more, or are they just buying more?
They're just buying more. So their average price we mentioned last week. So their cost basis is 78K per Bitcoin. Mm-hmm. So it's higher than the price now. So they are underwater. So they got $5 billion in unrealized losses. And Michael Saylor is still buying more. He added $90 million worth of Bitcoin. This was actually Michael Saylor on CNBC when asked about his strategy here.
If Bitcoin falls 90% for the next 4 years, we'll refinance the debt.
You refinance where, Michael?
Well, we'll just roll it forward. I mean, again,
you think banks would lend to you at that point?
Yeah, because the volatility of Bitcoin is such that there's always going to be value.
We'll just roll it forward.
We'll just write it off. Yeah. Just write it off.
I mean, people are worried. Some people are worried about this. I saw this clip played all over on my timeline that, you know,
fear is in right now, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I'm still not worried. I mean, if like I'm Michael Saylor specifically, the debt that he has is just not insane. But I mean, if you had a lot of years below 50K Bitcoin, then things look shaky. Then things you get in trouble.
If we were truly cooked for good, if Bitcoin was cooked for good, then yes, Michael Strategy, Michael Saylor is also cooked for good too.
Yeah. BitMine, maybe in worse shape, you could say, at least from an unrealized loss
relatively
perspective.
Relatively speaking, yes. Uh-huh.
So BitMine has almost $8 billion in unrealized losses.
That's a lot
and
of
yet,
billions.
And yet, David, Tom Lee purchased another $100 million worth of ETH last week.
Amazing. Okay, so
I don't know where he's getting this money at this point, but he is a net buyer, which is frankly quite impressive. Also, Tom Lee, BitMine does not have the debt structure.
Yeah, they have zero
MicroStrategy
debt.
Does.
They have zero debt.
So, I mean,
they should take on some debt.
No one's going to lend to them in this environment, not while fear is in. Lastly, a rare insight into Goldman Sachs' crypto portfolio. And here's how it breaks down. So Goldman Sachs apparently has $2.3 billion worth of crypto. So they are buyers. And here's how they split this. 46% Bitcoin, 42% ETH, 6% XRP, 5% Solana. Rate that portfolio, David. What do you think about that spread?
I don't hate it. I hate 6% of it. I don't really care for the XRP, but I don't know if I'm Goldman Sachs, then maybe I'm into it. Yeah, I think that's great.
Not a bad portfolio.
There are
huh?
many people with much worse portfolios than that.
Yes. Yes, I might be one of them. I'm not sure yet, actually. All right, coming up next, David, you're going to tell me about prediction markets. They are on fire. And some of this news came from a Robinhood report that just shows how much growth prediction markets have had in the US this year. Also, Layer Zero launches an architecture. I think this is trying to front run Ethereum ZK architecture. We'll talk about all that and more. But before we do, we want to thank the sponsors that made this episode possible.
In 2024, emerging markets generated over $115 billion in annual yield for investors, with yields ranging between 10 to 40%. These are some of the highest, most persistent yields on Earth. The problem? DeFi can't access them. Brix changes this. Built on Mega ETH, Brix takes emerging market money markets and sovereign carry and turns them into composable primitives you can access straight from your wallet. While DeFi investors earn 3 to 6% on stablecoins and T-bills, institutions have been harvesting 10 to 50% yields backed by sovereign monetary policy. Brix connects these worlds with institutional-grade tokenization, local banking rails, compliance across jurisdictions, and real-time stablecoin settlement. Brix does the heavy lifting so DeFi can finally access real collateral and structured products on top of real-world yield. Even the best carry trades can be within reach. Brix brings DeFi's promise to the emerging world and brings emerging market yield to your wallet. Let the yield flow with Brix.
What if you could trade gold, Forex, and global markets with the same tools and speed that you use for crypto? That's exactly what BitGet TradFi unlocks. After strong beta demand, including over $100 million in single-day gold trading volume, BitGet TradFi is now live for all users. Inside of your existing BitGet account, you can trade 79 instruments across Forex, precious metals, indices, and commodities, all settled directly in USDT. No platform switching and no fiat conversions. This is BitGet's universal exchange vision in action. Crypto and traditional finance side by side. You get deep liquidity, low slippage, and leverage up to 500x, letting you apply crypto strategies to macro markets. New to TradFi? Start with gold. The gold USD pair is liquid, macro driven, and a familiar natural bridge between crypto and traditional markets. Try trading gold on BitGet now at bitget.com. Click the link in the show notes for more information. This is not financial advice.
So Ryan, yesterday we got the Robinhood earnings report. And as you know, in Q4, maybe even it was even in Q3, was really when Robinhood rolled out their prediction markets product. In Q3, it was all Kalshi in the back end. And then they also announced that they are rolling their own prediction market. And so they're building one natively into the Robinhood app. And so we have a couple quarters of data of how much volume and their revenue Robinhood is actually making from prediction markets.
That's great data actually to have.
Ready?
Yeah.
In Q3... this is not the quarter that was being reported. Q4 was being reported, but last quarter, $115 million in annualized revenue from Q3 of 2025. That grew to $435 million revenue.
That is called product market fit. They have an audience for this.
That is 11% of Robinhood's revenue this last quarter came from prediction markets. 11% on a brand new product.
Up from 0%.
Up from 0%. Imagine you stumble into a new product. You're already a massively like revenue positive business and you stumble into a new product that adds 11% of revenue.
Incredible.
Onto your, that is crazy.
Okay.
Robinhood controls 35% of US prediction markets by volume. There's some split there between them and Kalshi, and then also Polymarket is in the game as well. And so we're just kind of seeing massive growth inside of, I'll call Robinhood an incumbent, inside of an incumbent who are leveraging this as well. It's no surprise that Coinbase and even Gemini are all doing the prediction market stuff because it seems to be very revenue positive. And Ryan, one last thing on this. This is not the quarter that Super Bowl and March Madness volume is going to be reported. That will be next quarter.
Wow.
So next quarter is the Super Bowl and March Madness quarter.
I saw this tweet. Prediction markets did $1.33 billion on the Super Bowl, just the Super Bowl,
just the Super Bowl.
Apparently, that's 10x what Vegas did.
I don't know if the 10x versus Vegas is totally accurate because there might be apples to oranges there with volume in Vegas versus, but nonetheless, the growth is
incredible.
Is crazy.
Yeah. Just for one event, the Super Bowl event. But so with the success, there's some pushback. I see pushback in three different maybe dimensions, but one of them is certainly this question about insider trading. This is a clip from CNBC interview with Kalshi founder.
You're doing the first thing. How are you making sure that as a marketplace, you are limiting the impact of a person who has control over the bet that you're placing or that you're offering? Doesn't manipulate it either for their own gain by being able to place bets or being able to tell their friends and family what would go along with those lines. It's bizarre to me to be able to bet on these things and have someone who completely controls the outcome and you don't know if they're betting or if their friends and family are betting on it.
Well, the insider trading risk is very real for a stock market as well and has been real since the stock market has begun.
But I feel like we control that and we can trace it. The SEC can very quickly find out who profits by how much, and they shut that down. Do you do the same thing on Kalshi?
We do the exact same thing on Kalshi. So as a regulated financial market by the CFTC, we have the same rules as the NASDAQ and the NYSE, and we have the same mechanism of enforcement.
What's grinding my gears, Ryan, about a lot of the discourse from trad media and like the trad world about prediction markets is that they seem to be just giving an undue level of responsibility to managing insider trading to the platforms. Now, like the platforms, they do have some responsibility. And, you know, Tariq from Kalshi said it, like we are doing the same things that all the other platforms are doing. The difference is that there's probably a lot more gray area, but more aggregate surface area for insider trading to happen when, like, the promise of a prediction market is you can bet on anything. And so, you know, in equities markets or, you know, commodities markets, there's more, it's more specific about when there is insider knowledge versus not. And with a prediction market where you can bet on anything, it's far more nuanced. But these are questions for the CFTC. So I would like the Squawk Box found people, interviewers, to stop pestering prediction market platform people who are doing the same thing as all these other venues, and then go ask those questions to the CFTC. We are bringing on Mike Selig, the new CFTC chair, and we will ask him those questions because that is the appropriate person to ask these questions to, in my opinion.
This is a hot button political item. So one item is insider trading and sort of how do you deal with that? What does that look like in prediction markets? Another question is who gets to regulate it? And this is hot button because it feels very much there's a set of incumbents and these might be states, states in the United States of America, states like Nevada maybe, that house Las Vegas, versus the CFTC, which is a federal entity, and who gets to regulate these things? And then you have a set of incumbents who used to do things like sports betting versus the prediction markets, which are allowing trading in all sorts of markets to include sports events, as we just saw. This is ex-Governor Chris Christie, obviously a political pundit. I believe prediction markets are violating the law, he says. In 40 states, we have regulated betting. I can't market to teenagers. Pays state taxes, protects game integrity, and reports suspicious activity to law enforcement. Prediction markets do none of that. So the charge here is that it's completely unregulated. The CFTC chair, Mike Selig, who you just mentioned, quoted this tweet and said, strong disagree. So he's making the case that no, there is a regulator here. It's called the CFTC. It's a federal regulator, and we span all of the states in the union, and we've got this and are handling it. So that's a hot button political issue at this point.
I wonder if the future of prediction markets is going to get down to the granularity onto the prediction market itself. So like a prediction market like the one from Polymarket that we talked about earlier, what's the probability that Bitcoin will be at $100,000 this year? That is a strict financial tool.
That is pure CFTC.
That is a pure CFTC.
100%.
What is the probability that a roulette ball will land on red? That's purely sports gambling, right?
Well, I mean, roulette is maybe that's a, we already know the probability, but like maybe you're saying the probability of some sort of
but you could spin up a prediction market.
Sure.
To guess the probability, like for example, here's a better example. There was a very pretty high volume prediction market on Polymarket about what the coin flip was at the Super Bowl, heads or tails. is that
so
a financial
stupid.
Instrument?
I hope it was 50-50, right?
Well, it was 50-50.
Breaking some, okay, thank
but
God.
But people were betting on it because you can bet on anything. So is that a financial instrument that should be regulated by the CFTC? Or is that sports gambling that needs to be regulated by the states? It's a case-by-case basis on the market,
sure,
and I wonder if the future regulation is going to have to get that granular.
Yeah, that's maybe, but I mean, how good are governments and regulators in getting that granular? You need some broad principles, I think, in order to do something here. So there's the insider trading kind of hot-button issue, incumbents versus disruptors. Other people, I think, see any of this, any markets, as the gamblification of society, and they don't like it.
Yeah.
I think a lot of your position with respect to prediction markets probably hinges on, we've said this before, how you feel about markets in general.
Yeah.
So I have a net favorable view of markets in general. I think they are good mechanisms for organizing and coordinating society for truth.
Markets
right?
are tight.
Yeah. If you believe in markets, you want to let the innovation go here. You think a public good is being produced, which is a truth machine. Not to say there won't be bumps along the way, there will be, but you fix those as they go. Yeah. You kind of open things up. If you hate markets, if you do not believe in markets, you probably don't like prediction markets
at all.
If you
like control, and if you like rules, and perhaps you lean authoritarian,
or central,
you probably don't really like markets
as much. If you lean, hey, centralized solutions will fix things, right?
Yeah.
You see this as a public bad. You see this as more gamblification. So this is a societal level cultural debate as well. And it'll be interesting to see how this all shakes out.
Yeah. It will continue to be a theme for the rest of this year. Let's get into some topics around some chains. A tale of three different chains, Layer Zero, Robinhood, Mega ETH, three different chains. Each one had news this week.
Yeah, and I think they each have different strategies. So Layer Zero, it feels like they are trying to front run the Ethereum roadmap, whereas the other two
I've
are
that
doing
one before.
You have. The other two mm-hmm. are doing some sort of roll-up type play, Gen 1 type roll-up play or Gen 2. So let's talk about what Layer Zero is doing. This kind of came out of nowhere, felt like, but they released this long architectural blog post, essentially, on Twitter, and they were describing something called Zero, the decentralized multi-core world computer. World computer, David. It's been a long time since we've heard that, but that is certainly how Ethereum came on the scenes. What this is, of course, Layer Zero is a bridge platform, bridge company. They have had a lot of success with respect to bridging crypto assets from one chain to another. That's what they're known for. Now they are getting into the Layer 1 chain business. Some points of interest. This is a ZK EVM. So it's EVM compatible, uses Risk Zero, if you're familiar with that. It's an L1, as I mentioned. ZK proofs for verification. So it's very similar to the Ethereum roadmap in that you should be able to verify and run validators from consumer level hardware. That's what they are targeting here. They're doing things like vertical trees, which is, you know, a little more distant on the Ethereum roadmap. Slot times, low latency, pre-confirmations for users. Mainnet in the fall, using something called Jolt, which is an A16Z ZK EVM. So what this reminds, and this is maybe...
Developed by A16Z, I think is worth highlighting.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. Developed by them. So this is smelling and sounding a lot like kind of Tempo in some ways. So Tempo, again, Paradigm produced client, now Paradigm talent, sucking in a lot of talent from the Ethereum ecosystem and basically trying to front run the Ethereum roadmap. That's what I'm seeing with Layer Zero. They're like, hey, nice roadmap you have over there. ZK is amazing. We're going to get to it faster than you.
It'd be
you.
A shame if somebody else didn't have all your tech debt and could move really quickly.
Yes. And so that is exactly what they're doing. And they're also backed by an impressive assortment of companies and individuals. Did you see some of the launch partners here?
Yeah, it kind of reminded me of our conversation with Canton. So it's Tempo in the sense of front running Ethereum to get to the end game faster. It's also seemingly like Canton, which is a lot of giving corporations their sovereignty over their own little region of the network.
Yes.
In the same way that Ethereum has, like, you know, Robinhood chain for a layer two. Citadel Securities, the DTC, ICE, Intercontinental Exchange.
ICE for that one.
The markets based ICE. So kind of some of the biggest launch partners that you could really ask for here as it relates to, you know, traditional market infrastructure.
Do you remember back in, was it 2018 or 2019? Near. Do you remember when Near came on the scene?
Yeah, this is also, reminiscent of Near. It was like, Ethereum is so slow. We're just going to front run to the end.
Yeah, exactly. We have the better engineers. You guys are a bunch of researchers, Ethereum Foundation. We are executors. Yeah. We're engineers, and we're going to front run all of your great roadmap ideas. And Near has since pivoted, I think, from that strategy, it's safe to say.
Doesn't mean that this won't be successful. Evolved. They kind of evolved their strategy, but they have left a lot behind. Yeah.
Sure. Reminds me of that. I mean, we see these archetypes each cycle.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
The hard thing is going to be to bootstrap that network effect. And then, you know, what about the token itself? It's very much VC. It's, you know, it's hard to make a case that
it's
going to
become
a monetary unit.
It doesn't have the distribution of Ether, the asset. That's right.
That's right. Yeah. That's right.
And like, you can't, we have seen before, I think what you're saying is we have seen before that you can't just build Ethereum in a in an ivory tower and skip to the end. That's good. Like, it's great if you can, but like, the things that make Ethereum special are in addition to that.
Well, what's notable is they weren't just talking about kind of being an Ethereum killer and all of Ethereum's failings, but they were also talking about being a Solana killer as well. So I guess good for Solana for making it into the stage that you have killers coming after you.
I mean, I think it is the right position of a chain like this to say, hey, everything beyond Bitcoin, we're going for that.
Yeah, I think so. Robinhood, layer two.
Yes.
Now their testnet came out, David.
Yep.
What's this?
So this is their long-awaited Robinhood chain. Testnet has launched. So it's up and about. The important thing is that they are doing the public permissionless chain, the open developer ecosystem chain. which is like alongside many of the other layer twos, alongside Base. What I think is unique about this is how Robinhood intends to use this. Over, Ryan, since the start of this year, we have talked about the New York Stock Exchange tokenization plan. We've talked about the NASDAQ plan to build out a blockchain-based exchange. The Robinhood chain is, from my read on this, is their strategy to go toe-to-toe with those two gargantuans, those two incumbents, by producing an exchange as a blockchain, but as an Ethereum layer two. And so it's going to be this open developer ecosystem that we know of. It's going to have hackathons. You know, they'll have presence at many of the Ethereum events, which I think is the unique thing and why I find Robinhood's strategy more resonant than NASDAQ's or the New York Stock Exchange's.
I'm pretty excited about it, actually. Yeah. You notice the things that Robinhood does, they tend to execute on. So when they glom onto something new, we just talked about prediction markets, right? Mm-hmm. Suddenly prediction markets is fueling a massive amount of their business. Mm-hmm. They tend to execute well, get UX right. They have a good idea as far as connecting some of these technologies to their end product. So I'm pretty bullish on that.
I'm pretty bullish.
Yes, I know. By the way, were they up or down after the earnings call?
Very down, which was surprising. And it continues to be down in this moment. But right. I continue to buy more.
Maybe that makes you more bullish on the downside then. Mega ETH mainnet also launched, and the Aztec token launched as well. The Mega ETH mainnet seemed to go pretty well.
Yeah. That's right. Yeah, there's been a lot of rabbling on the timeline that like it's not launching to big fanfare like chains of the past. I think people were really looking for a Blast or Barrachain type playbook where the chain, you cut the ribbon, all the apps open up, there's incentives everywhere. People are just like spraying tokens around. That's just not what's going on. Like read the room, guys. Like we have very few users in this present moment. And also we've been talking about how indiscretionary token distributions have resulted in poor investment vehicles. And the strategy for that I can tell from Mega ETH and its app ecosystem is to be highly discretionary on this token. And I wrote an article about this because like people were just giving what I felt were obsolete and outdated takes. There's just a new playbook out there. Aztec is doing the same playbook too. They have a line here that I really, really liked. Every token holder of Aztec has a cost basis, as in every holder of Aztec purchased, invested in the token. The launch price is being established by price discovery in the public. No insider staking in the Aztec ecosystem, plus 36-month insider lockups, and then on-chain liquidity. Doing it just hard mode. And
these are bear market launches. These are bear market launches. Yeah. And some of the best like ROIs in history have been, in crypto history, have been these bear market launches.
That's right.
And you have to factor that in. But of course, sentiment is against it when you look at the token price. So this is the Aztec token. You're just talking about that. They've raised just even recently $157 million. They're now trading at a $59 million market cap, $215 million FDV. That's Aztec. Remember Zama as well?
Yeah.
They have launched $185 million market cap. Mega holding out a bit more, at least on some of the futures market. I think it was, do you say $1.8 billion?
$1.3 billion. So it's up 30% from the presale.
Okay. Up 30% still from the presale, still hanging on to that. Layer Zero got a nice bump this week on layer two news.
Doesn't look terrible. That looks
$2 billion. Uh-huh. But I'm just saying some of these tokens are launching at some pretty low valuations.
We were once very upset about the high FTV, low float meta. That is not what we're getting. We're getting the low FTV, semi low float.
Still high float. Yeah, definitely. So maybe they crash down to earth. It could be a good buying opportunity if one of these really survives and thrives post this market. Which brings to a question about what the use cases are for crypto. There's this debate on crypto Twitter, primarily I think between Chris Dixon, who wrote a post on the long game for crypto, and also Hasib. Basically, Chris's take is, use cases beyond financial use cases for crypto, they're not dead. They're just in the future. And we have been hampered and locked by being too early to some of these things. The policy was a missing piece. Previously, he'd said cheap block space was a missing piece. But non-financial use cases in crypto, the full story, that's intact. And Hasib, he pushed back and he said, hey, you got to call a spade at this point in time. Every single use case in crypto that has worked at scale has been financial in nature. I respect Chris's optimism, but 18 years in, we shouldn't be propagating this Web2 meme, consumer use case meme. It's all about finance all of the way down.
This debate, which is a debate that we've been having in the weekly rollup for the last like 3 weeks, it's been the theme of the year so far. This one's downstream on the fact that the two Farcaster founders, Dan and Varun, joined Tempo. So, you know, Tempo, the chain that's optimizing for stablecoins,
financial use cases,
is taking the two lead talent from the on-chain social use case, the two leaders, and that's going into the finance world. So
reallocating capital, capital.
Sign of the times. Yeah. And Base also removed the Farcaster social feed. So Base, remember how Jesse Pollock was so aggressive and determined about getting on-chain social and consumer creator coins as to be a thing? So they removed the Farcaster post from the Base tab. And so Jesse said the app needs to have one primary focus, and that thing is trading.
Trading.
I was the biggest advocate for bringing Farcaster content into the Base app and continue to believe in the multi-client world, but we've realized we need to do less better by focusing on tradable assets. So Base removing some of the on-chain social elements out of the app. And so, you know, that brings us once again back to this debate, this time between Chris and Haseeb about like, is on-chain social like a real thing or is it not a real thing? My take is that
it's not just on-chain social. Let's broaden that to sure. Use cases beyond finance.
Use cases beyond finance. Yes. Yes. There's something in Chris's article that I really didn't like, which is his line, policy is the missing piece. And I think Haseeb appropriately called that out when he said, does that really pass the smell test? it just doesn't feel right. Like it, I don't think we will get the Clarity Act or what other legislation we need through Congress, and all of a sudden on-chain social or non-financial use cases on crypto just will blossom. Like the more moderate in-between take that I can agree with that Chris said is that we need the financial use case of blockchains to proliferate for the next decade. Hmm. And we need wallets to get into the hands of more people naturally through UX improvements, products improvements. And we just need the first wave of crypto to really mature generationally. And then maybe we can talk about less financial
a
use
long
cases.
Way out, you mean?
But there's a strict order of operations. And in 2021 through 2023, we tried to build all of them in parallel.
Yeah.
And if on-chain social or non-financial use cases of crypto have a chance, it's because we did the finance thing extremely thoroughly for a long time first.
I pretty much believe that too. And I will point out though that Chris Dixon's read write own, he's saying that own is crypto. That's still right on, but own, that's a financial verb basically, right?
Yep.
I mean, it's property
yep.
rights. That's the core of things. And so I give more on Haseeb's side of the argument, certainly yep. in the short to midterm. But I think some elements of what Chris is saying will turn out over the long run too. Dave, we got more to talk about. BlackRock teams up with Uniswap?
Wow.
That's so crazy. Wow. That would have blown my mind 4 years ago.
Barbell strategy.
Also, Mr. Beast is launching a bank, and the SafeMoon founder, I forgot about this guy, he got 100 months in jail. We'll talk about all that and more, but before we do. Yeah, that's a lot of months. Before we do, got to thank the sponsors that made this episode possible.
Hey, Bankless Nation, it's David. If you're hearing this, that's because you are listening to the free Bankless podcast feed. Did you know that there is a premium Bankless RSS feed? The premium feed has extra interviews that I do for my own personal research and just deeper questions that I want answered about the crypto industry, questions that I want to answer so I can be more informed as an investor, both at Bankless Ventures and also just in my own personal portfolio too. Also, there are no ads, which means if you listen to the premium feed instead of the free feed, you'll get about 20 hours of your life back every year because you choose to support Bankless directly. So if you're interested in getting extra content all while skipping the ads, or you just appreciate what we do here and want us to keep doing it, we'd appreciate it if you signed up for Bankless Premium. And there is a link in the show notes to get started. Cheers to a good 2026. Few people in crypto put real skin in the game when they make public top or bottom calls. The DeFi Report is one of them. The week before the October 10th flash crash, Michael from the DeFi Report emailed his entire newsletter saying he's going aggressively risk off and sold the majority of his book from crypto into cash. This is when ETH was about 4,000 $100,000 and Bitcoin was $110,000. Michael runs the DeFi Report, an industry-leading research platform built on data, cycle awareness, risk management, transparency, and most importantly, skin in the game. We like Michael at Bankless. We like his analysis, and that's why you hear him on the Bankless podcast about once a month. And the DeFi Report is giving Bankless listeners one free month of access to the DeFi Report. So if you're looking for some sharp, data-driven analysis to make better informed decisions around your portfolio, you can learn why and how Michael called the top and what he's doing next, all in the DeFi Report Pro. Check it out. There is a link in the show notes.
So Vitalik has been on this Milady arc, let's say, where he ends these posts this year with Milady, and he's basically just saying, I'm saying what I feel like, you know, it's time for me to be uncensored, okay? And so last week, it was about layer twos and the strategy. We've talked about that. The one thing I was waiting for him to say that I feel like was not said, but that he actually believed, I tweeted this. I said, the last say the quiet out loud thing I'd like to hear from Vitalik is that ETH is a store of value and one of the most important apps on Ethereum. And he actually said it. So he repeated that word for word, David.
I think he copied and pasted your tweet and then just use it.
He didn't just copy and paste because he added a period here. So you see, that's distinctly different. So he put some effort into it. But he said, ETH is a store of value and one of the most important apps on Ethereum. He's kind of said this before in some places, though not as explicitly and not tied together, that ETH is a store of value. It's a monetary asset. And it's also the most important things on Ethereum. So it was good to hear him say it. And the reason that's important for me is because I don't think ETH's architecture and trade-offs and all of the things that it's done so far make any sense unless you actually believe that. Right. And I will kind of like, that's a hill I've chosen to die on, right? Yeah. Whether it becomes a consensus store of value or not, and whether it wins that race, wins that game, I can't say for certain, but all of the choices and the entire project doesn't make sense unless you believe that.
Right.
And I had not heard Vitalik articulate that. Right. And so now he has, I felt fulfilled. Yeah. By this tweet, David.
There's been like two equivalent dispositions. One is that ETH is the greatest app on Ethereum because of all the choices that Ethereum has made. It has bestowed an incredible set of properties in the native currency.
Yes.
And then there's an equivalent but distinct disposition, which is we need to do everything we can to the economic security of the network to preserve the properties of the network. And so it's a cart before the horse, or like an order of operations thing where Vitalik previously, and maybe to this day, it has been like, I don't care about Ether, but I will do whatever I need to do to Ether to protect Ethereum. And as it turns out, all of those things make Ether an incredible store of value. And so your disposition is like, let's put Ether first and talk about Ether as an incredible app. And Vitalik is like, I just did what I needed to do to make Ethereum powerful. And you're like, that's the same thing.
I agree. It's the same thing. And it's all part of kind of the yin and yang of this. I will just add. So I felt like the missing piece was the question of what is all this uncensorable, massively max decentralized block space for?
What are we doing here?
What is it for?
Why
can you just
are we
tell
here?
Me what it's for clearly? Okay. And the thing that it's for is Ether as a store of value asset and all of the decentralized finance around that. That has been
everything
our thesis from day
on
one.
Ethereum will die, but there will still be Ether as a good, solid store of value.
Anyway, that's mission accomplished, you know, almost 6 years into this podcast, David. We got that. And
let's back it up.
Yeah, so you pack it up. Also, on this note, was interesting this week, David, back to the L1, that movement is happening. So ENS, you know, the .eth extensions, they actually had a strategy to develop a layer two, and they have now reverted back, and they're saying the next version of their protocol ever after, it's going to be deployed on the layer one. We're going back to the L1, back to mainnet. The reason they gave is like, Nick from ENS threw this out. He's basically like, gas fees are low. There's a scaling roadmap in place. It made more sense for ENS to be on Ethereum. Mm-hmm. Vitalik backed that up. And he said, it's a good decision. ENS names and records are a form of state that's central to the Ethereum ecosystem. You know, so they're staying on the L1. I would like to echo
ENS,
a point you made.
ENS
yes.
is staying on the L1. That is, it's crazy that's crazy. The Ethereum name service is deciding to stay on Ethereum.
Oh my God, we could have saved some more time. I was reflecting on part of your rant from our episode that we dropped last Saturday, which is just like, we could have figured this out, you know, two years ago.
Yeah,
so much sooner and gave more clarity. But here we are now.
And wasted less capital and effort and labor.
Yeah. And good news for adoption. This is a Hayden Adams saying this is a huge day for DeFi. I got to agree. So BlackRock, the largest asset manager in the world, $14 trillion AUM, and Biddle, their tokenized fund, they are coming to Uniswap. What's happening here?
Why is that a big deal is the first question, the first big question. The answer is that, you know, Uniswap is a permissionless AMM, but Biddle, the token, is not a permissionless token. You need to be, your address needs to be whitelisted onto that token. So we have a security token, a regulated security.
An actual security.
Not a
Gary Gensler.
An actual security. Being traded through Uniswap, which is pretty sick. It's pretty sick that we can do that. It's also pretty sick that BlackRock is doing it because that is not a trivial thing to do.
Yeah.
Like putting your security in a decentralized, like the lawyers need to look at that in every way, shape, and form, you know, like CZ style, spread the butt cheeks. And they did it and they gave the thumbs up.
Butt cheeks.
And so so we have the blessing of BlackRock's lawyers that you can put securities into Uniswap, which I think will make it.
If BlackRock's doing it, everyone else can do it. You know, the other thing they did though here, David, which is kind of cute and kind of good. BlackRock actually bought some Uni tokens.
Yeah.
All right. So they wanted to have. They purchased. I don't know how much they purchased. Did you get that?
I didn't see how much. I don't know if it was disclosed.
Okay.
On this news, the price of Uniswap
got a candle
soared.
From got a candle.
$3.30 all the way up to
25% candle.
All the way up to where'd it go? $4.
Yeah.
To where then retraced back to $3.30.
People were temporarily bullish on tokens again and then they forgot why they're bearish.
The token bullish half-life is so quick right now.
This is the thing though. BlackRock and Uniswap, like $14 trillion in assets. Mm-hmm. Partners with a DeFi protocol, that is absolutely massive. In a bull market, things would be going bonkers on this
news.
And it's barely a whisper, but is a pretty big deal long term. Mr. Beast is acquired a Gen Z focused banking app and financial services company. Okay. I saw a lot of crypto people in my feed very excited about this because I think of the Tom Lee Bitmine investment of $200 million into Beast Industries. And so they were trying to extrapolate and connect some dots and basically say, this means Beast, Mr. Beast and his bank will do the DeFi mullet and will also provide Gen Z a way to buy crypto assets, maybe putting Ether in Ethereum in a primacy position there because of the Tom Lee influence. Mm-hmm. And I think there's no evidence of any of that. But if you squint, you can kind of see it. And it is notable that content creators like Beast, media providers are getting so deep into the financial sector. Like that's kind of surprising to me.
Yeah. Allegedly, Mr. Beast has announced that he's going to launch a finance-focused YouTube channel explaining topics like investing. Like he's using his distribution arm to just like king make finance apps that he buys. I don't know if it's really that easy. Like you can't just have distribution. Like you need to have a CEO like Vlad from Robinhood, for example, somebody like him to really lead the charge here.
Yeah.
I don't think you
influencer
just win automatically having the world's greatest distribution, but we'll see.
Yeah, this is hilarious. My rep at Mr. Beast Bank said I can have 9% APY savings account, but I do have to live in the bank vault for 100 days. Maybe. Weird things have happened.
You got kids, Ryan. Do your kids like...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, they like Mr. Beast?
I watch some Beast, too. I mean, you can't not, right? It's pretty wholesome, too.
If your kids sign up for Mr. Beast instead of Robinhood, you got to let me know because I got to sell my Robinhood shares.
Dude, they would be so excited to do a Beast bank. I mean, they eat Beast bars. You know, he's got like candy and stuff.
I think they're healthy. They're claimed to be healthy. I think that's the spirit of them.
That's not why they're buying it, okay? David, you can now give your OpenClaw AI agent a self-custodial wallet. This is a Coinbase rolling out a new agentic wallet for crypto. They give AI agents a self-custodied wallet so that they can do all of the money verbs. What do you think of this?
Dude, Ryan, you know how we were just talking about, like, there's no users. People aren't going on to Mega ETH because it's not paying them bajillions of dollars, blah, 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 blah. We're watching the Super Bowl ads and everyone, all the humans are like, yeah, I'm fucking Coinbase. Like, we don't like crypto.
Middle fingers up.
And then what happens when Coinbase just spawns 1 trillion users with AI really enjoy transacting on blockchains?
I'm so ready for it. This is all this agentic wallet, right? When we were talking to Austin Griffith last week. Mm-hmm. And he was like, yeah, I hooked up my OpenClaw and now it can open MetaMask and click through all the stupid windows to get a transaction signed. But it turns out it just prefers a command line. It's trying to extract my private keys so it can do all the shit on its own.
And I'm like, no, don't do that.
Yeah, it was so obvious. It's so obvious that what crypto needs to do is basically pivot to AI agents as users.
And as an industry,
build products
we need to
like
just
this.
Spawn users.
Yeah.
We will just build them ourselves.
Yeah, that's right. Anyway, and the first step is giving them a wallet that the AI agents are going to enjoy.
Totally.
And they will enjoy this. It's all command line. It's fantastic.
Totally.
I think
totally.
This is the next big narrative coming out of crypto.
Yeah.
It's probably going to be the thing that's
going
to be.
Yeah, you remember the AI bubble of a year ago?
Yes.
What happens when that's not just a small sector of crypto, but that's the whole industry?
And notice, David, it's a financial use case, okay? The agents aren't coming for on-chain social.
I did notice that.
Very cool. Also, Stripe just joined the X402 payments on Base. Mm. So that's another step in that direction.
Ryan, do you remember SafeMoon?
I remember it. It was a scam in the midst of many scams
that
were happening
about?
At the time.
It was safe and going to the moon, bro. It was in the name.
Did we even get in a fight with these guys? I don't even remember.
We probably did.
Okay.
Okay,
what happened? What was safe? It was a meme coin? What was safe?
It was a meme coin that, again, was promised to be safe and to go to the moon. This was promised by Braden John Carney, the founder and CEO of SafeMoon, who was just recently sentenced to 8 years in a federal prison for defrauding SafeMoon investors because it was not safe and it did not go to the moon. So conspiracy to commit securities fraud, conspiracy to commit wire fraud, conspiracy to commit money laundering, just basically threw the book at him. This happened in 2021. So if anyone was looking for closure on the SafeMoon story, here it is. Founder, 8 years in jail. Turns out crime is still crime. It just lags a little bit.
I want to believe that. I want to believe that crime is still crime.
Crime is still crime.
Sometimes it
unless
is.
Unless you're the president.
Unless you could pardon.
And then you can do whatever you want.
Actually, can we get to that really quick? So all in my timeline this week has been SBF propaganda.
Oh, dude, he needs to shut the fuck up, man.
Tweets of SBF. And by the way, I can't even figure out how he's tweeting from prison, but someone's got his account.
He's allegedly tweeting through a friend.
All right. And it is glazing Trump.
Yes.
It is like,
yes.
So quote tweeting a Trump Truth Social tweet and saying under Biden, all the companies were forced offshore. Under real Donald Trump, they're welcome back in America. The Democrats are insane. Just absolutely glazing Trump. And you know why, right? You know why.
He's trying to get the pardon.
This man wants a pardon.
He wants a pardon. He doesn't want to serve his 25 years.
Okay, and I think he's putting all this effort in. In fact, someone probably vibe coded the missing billions. This is the value of all of the FTX assets with their estimated value today. Trying to make the propaganda case that basically FTX was always solvent.
Mm-hmm.
Sam Bankman-Fried did nothing wrong. It was some other nefarious group. You've seen this plane over. I saw Melton Dumaris predict that SBF gets a pardon. By summertime, a Trump pardon by summertime. Let me tell you, like, my head would explode.
No fucking way is that happening. Can I take the other side of that?
We should spin up. You should find a polymarket for that.
Will SBF get? Well, that would be below 10%.
You think
below
so?
5%. The crypto industry will not allow SBF. What does he have to offer Trump?
Money. Well,
does he?
I don't know.
He doesn't have any money, bro.
I don't know. I'm worried that he has stuff that he could offer Trump. And if you have stuff, you can just get that presidential pardon. That's my worry.
No, the crypto industry, who also has given stuff to Trump and can continue to give stuff to Trump, would be in an uproar about that.
I hope so. I mean, I'm seeing more and more of this propaganda, and I'm just worried that the narrative reverses and we start letting our crypto criminals out of prison again. And, there's no such thing as There's no such thing as law.
You know what closure I would like with Sam Bankman-Fried and the whole FTX saga that I have not gotten?
What's that?
Where is the 12-inch tungsten cube that he shipped to the Bahamas?
What?
Did you know
this? This trail? No.
Yeah. So they bought. Remember the tungsten cube mania, which I'm pretty sure was started by Nick Carter. Everyone wanted tungsten cubes. I have two tungsten cubes. One, because I bought one myself, because every man in crypto needs a tungsten cube. And two, the second tungsten cube that I got for beating Kane in our fight.
Right?
Beat Kane in the fight. Got his tungsten cube. So during the tungsten cube mania, FTX, Sam Bankman-Fried, bought a 12-inch tungsten cube, which is something like 40,000 pounds and like $250,000. That's the whole bit about
40,000 pounds?
They had to forklift it into the FTX offices in the Bahamas. So it's not something that you can just lose. You have to forklift it. And so where did that go? I want to know.
That's David's main concern right now.
12-inch tungsten cube.
Wait, are you a buyer? Are you
I don't want to spend $250,000 on tungsten in 2026. I would just like to know where it went.
Well, big mystery to end the roll-up on. Let's end it there. Got to let you know, none of this has been financial advice. You could lose what you put in, but we are headed west. This is the frontier. It's not for everyone, but we're glad you're with us on the Bankless journey. Thanks a lot.